looking at me fondly. "Thank you, Eugene," I said flatly. "I understand now."
"Bless you." He squeezed my arm. "We shall do great work here, Hope, you and I."
I walked out into the moist, warm darkness of the African night with a new sense of purpose.
But she's not giving up that easily. Tomorrow, Hope takes Eugene to see the violent chimp behaviour for himself, but is completely unprepared for his reaction. Brazzaville Beach by William Boyd was read by Fiona Shaw and produced by Pete Atkin. Imagine you're a child of 12 and you've spent almost half your life living away from your family as an evacuee. That's the situation Rusty finds herself in Michelle Magorian's award-winning story, Back Home. Rusty has been in America during the Second World War, and her return proves difficult for both her and her mother.
Hey, look at that house! It's got no walls! It looks like a stage set.
Yes, Plymouth's taken a lot of bombing. They'll be knocking all the bombed-out houses down soon, thank God.
Oh, that would make such a great open-air theatre. I mean, you could get all the chairs and stick them out around...
We have to be going.
Is that church medieval?
No.
It looks real old.
Don't you remember anything about England?
Back Home is here on BBC Radio 4 Extra on Sunday morning at 9 and again at 5 o'clock.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we begin John Osborne's Radiohead, one young man's journey through the airwaves of British radio. To relieve the tedium of temping in an office, the author decided to listen to a different radio station every day and to record his observations and discoveries as he journeyed up and down the dial. The reader is Lee Ingleby, and the programme was first broadcast in 2009.
This is Christian O'Connell Breakfast Show. So our big guest this morning, and it's the only time Richard, my producer, has ever given up his chair for a guest.
It's 7:30 a.m, and I listen to Virgin Radio's Christian O'Connell as the nation butters its toast and straightens its hair. The theme of today's show is marriage. The listener who tells Christian the best story of their wedding wins two first-class tickets to New York. Sandra is on air. I brush my teeth, tie my tie. I was 19 and looking after my sister's house while she was away, she tells O'Connell. And there was a knock at the door. A man was stood there with a baby boy in his arms. He asked for my sister, and when I told him that she'd gone on holiday, he looked really disappointed and turned away. I'd never seen a man who looked so sad, so I called him back, asked if he was okay. He turned round, said he needed someone to talk to, so I invited him in. He told me his girlfriend had just left him for another man, and she had told him that no court in the world would give custody to him ahead of the baby's mother. He had seen a lawyer, Sandra continues, who told him the only way of getting custody of his son would be if he was married. He told me he didn't know many women, certainly not any who would agree to marry him. And without even thinking about it, I said, "You could ask me." He looked at me, then went down on one knee and said, "Will you marry me?" "You have got to be joking," O'Connell says, aghast. I am standing by the front door, keys in my hand. I have to leave for work, but I can't. I want to hear more of Sandra's story. And 6 days later, we were married. "But surely you didn't love each other?" Christian asks. "We discussed that," replies Sandra. "But we agreed to worry about it later. The baby had to come first." And this was 25 years ago. "What an incredible story," O'Connell says, a trill of excitement in his voice for the first time this morning. "I want the movie rights. I want to get Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan involved." I take out my new portable radio and headphones, bought especially so I can carry on listening as I go to and from work. I don't want to miss out on a single minute. As I walk, O'Connell reads out texts and emails that are already flooding into the show. People say that Sandra has restored their faith in humanity, that like me, they are late for work because they didn't feel able to stop listening. There's already been two calls from tabloid newspapers asking for Sandra's story, O'Connell tells his increasingly gushing listeners as I get into work at 9:15. Sorry I'm late, I say to Alan Medlicott, who looks up from the folder his head is buried in and nods. Alan Medlicott is my boss, the tubby man with bright red cheeks. He sits opposite me, next to Craig, the new boy, who has a cherubic face and the side parting of a bank manager. Craig's 18 years old and has a pension plan, a briefcase, and a nodding grommet toy perched on his computer. Alan Medlicott likes him because he is very good with spreadsheets and offers to do overtime. Last night, I was in the pub with my friend, Mark, telling him I was going to listen to a different radio station every day, and he asked me if I'd ever listened to Christian O'Connell. He's brilliant, Mark told me. Easily the best person on radio. Ever the diligent friend, I tuned into Virgin when my alarm woke me this morning, but didn't like it. O'Connell, the self-styled daddy of morning radio, seemed to have an abrupt presenting style bordering on the aggressive, not just to listeners who call in, but towards his producer, Brian, who he treats like the kid at school who can't afford Nike trainers. O'Connell was involved in a high-profile transfer to Virgin from London station XFM and is considered to be one of the most exciting DJs around, mainly by Mark. Sandra is back on air again before the end of the show. Obviously you've won the competition, O'Connell tells her. You can tell your husband you're taking him to New York. No one else stood a chance. Is there anything you'd like to say to your new fans?
Oh, well, just to let them know that life is for living. You have to take risks if you want to be happy. Just do what you want to do.
It feels good to listen to the radio at my desk. I've been in the same job for 6 months and I've already run out of conversation with Alan Medlicott and Craig. My work is a lethal cocktail of data entry and filing. Listening to Virgin could be a welcome addition to my otherwise repetitive daily routine. Sandra's theory that you should do what you want to do is an axiom far removed from my own life, the words stick in my head like a radio jingle. At first, I thought of this kind of work as a stopgap, a way of earning some money while I developed the grand plan of what I was going to do with my life. But nothing ever materialised, and brittle temp jobs have become my career. Which is why listening to the radio at my desk appeals to me. It's a rebellion against the people with designated parking spaces who drive past me as I walk in the rain to and from work. At 1 o'clock, I switch off my computer and take out the sandwiches I made last night. Today it's cheese and onion. Neil Francis plays rock music. Muse, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Aerosmith. Then replays this morning's conversation between Sandra and Christine O'Connell. It's a lovely story, he says at the heartwarming conclusion. But do you think Sandra is telling the truth? I had briefly dabbled with the fact that the story might not be true, that she could have made it up, that Sandra is a massive fibber, but decided that it really doesn't matter. There is a chance that Sandra is a fantasist, that she isn't even called Sandra, but I believe her. I think she's nice, and that every word she said was true. Maybe that means I'm gullible. But I'm glad I heard her on the radio this morning. I'm glad that she is going to New York with her real-life husband, who definitely exists. But even if it's all lies, and that's fine with me too, her story works as a parable. That if you take risks, there is no limit to what you can achieve. As I don't have a very good memory, I open up a blank Word document and start typing up Sandra's story. No one's going to look up and suspect I'm not inputting data, that I'm actually typing up an anecdote I heard on Virgin Radio. At 4 o'clock, I sit at my desk waiting for the clock to turn. Since the Sandra story, there has been little more than adverts and songs. Amy Winehouse, The Who's Ears, Snow Patrol. This isn't what radio was made for. It's a long way from families huddled round the wireless listening to Chamberlain declaring war. Eventually, it's 5:30 and I'm out the door like a Japanese bullet train. The next day, I wake with a smile on my face and the desire to listen to another station for the day. My face covered in shaving cream, I switch on the radio in my kitchen as the country snaps, crackles and pops.
Oh,
listening to the BBC Asian Network. It's not a station I've ever heard before, and I'm intrigued. When I first decided to try out kinds of radio I wouldn't otherwise listen to, this was the station I thought of first. Something I wouldn't normally tune into, which is why it's exciting to give myself the opportunity. After two records, the presenter, Sonia Deal, talks about the increasing problem of faith healers advertising in the Asian press. It has been a recent phenomenon with adverts full of unlikely boasts, promises such as 100% guaranteed success and results every time. Sonia interviews the head of Trading Standards. He explains that the faith healers get away with it because victims rarely complain. In the last 2 years, he says, there have only been a dozen complaints. People are either too embarrassed to report anyone to the authorities or are superstitious that if they complain, then the matter which the faith healer has been dealing with will never be resolved. The problems faith healers have been solving vary from please make my boyfriend be nicer to me to I'm struggling to cope without my late wife. The man from Trading Standards continues, it's hard to prove that somebody isn't a faith healer. They can counter any allegation by maintaining that they believe they possess this special power. The only way they can be stopped is to have several people testify who have all been victims of similar scams. And then it can be proved there is a pattern. One woman paid a so-called healer £15,000 and pretended to her family that the money she was raising was for an operation she needed to save her life. Text or write in if you know of any similar incidents, Sonia encourages her listeners. I'll pass all your information to Trading Standards.
Good morning, you're listening to Nihal on the BBC Asian Network.
9 a.m. brings Nihal on air. I say hello to Alan Medlicott and Craig. They wave. Both of them on the phone. Neither of them hangs up and says, why do you keep turning up day after day? So I take off my coat and get on with my work. Nihal is one of Asian music's most important voices and is the lone name on today's schedule that I recognise, if only because I saw him on Nevermind the Buzzcocks once. This show is his day job and he clearly relishes tackling important issues. Today the main subject is whether honour killings are a genuine problem in the Asian community. I was beaten by my father for insulting my family honour, Sira tells Nihal. Why? I was 15 years old and refused to marry the man my father intended to be my husband. Eventually, I ran away from home and went into hiding. Nihal seems immediately concerned for her. I'm fine now, she continues, and I love my dad. I do not blame him. He was under so much pressure from the extended family. Nihal asks Sira to stay on the line as other callers comment on her situation. Abdullah tries to find justifications for the actions of Sira's father. You should have spoken to your father about the subject. He was angry because he found out from other people you were not marrying the man he had chosen for you. You can't justify the fact that he beat her up, can you, Abdullah? Nihal asks, slightly taken aback. You're a father. You have a baby girl. How are you going to bring her up to be a strong, independent woman? I will make her respect me. Surely you earn respect. Sira was not giving her father respect, Abdullah argues. The discussion is uninterrupted for an hour. There are no trails for other shows, no adverts, and most surprisingly, given Nihal's reputation with Asian music, he plays no songs. A girl tells him that her father is making her study at university so that as a bride she is more sellable and says she is genuinely concerned about the next generation of Asian kids. The most disturbing story is Sophia's. She tells Nihal she was married in secret at the age of 15 and she finally realised it was over a year later. If my dad finds me, he will kill me, she says. Her words sending a chill from my headphones, making my fingers temporarily numb to type at the keyboard. I don't see my family anymore. I live with a new boyfriend. Are you in hiding, Sophia? Yes. I was not sure what the Asian Network would be like, but as soon as Nihal's programme began, I was glued, captivated by a subject I know nothing about. The problems in my life extend to not being able to find my stapler. Sometimes it's easy to forget about people like Sira and Sophia while you're at work, swinging backwards on your chair, thinking about Poppy and accounts, and what you're going to have for your tea.
Lee Ingleby was reading Radiohead by John Osborne. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production from 2009.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. I'm Luke Tuddenham. An hour of drama to come in Daniel Defoe's adventure Robinson Crusoe, starring Roy Marsden. Then on today's 4 o'clock show, we've a brand new story, Terry Pratchett's A Hat Full of Sky, read by Shirley Henderson, who you might remember or recognise as Moaning Myrtle from the Harry Potter films. Witches, pixies and Mel Gedroych will all be rocking up in an hour. Now, a classic tale of adventure on the high seas and the consequences of going against a family's wishes. The first of our two-part adaptation of Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe.
The Life and Strange Adventures of Robinson Crusoe of York, Mariner, who lived many years on an uninhabited island on the coast of America, near the mouth of the great river Orinoco, having been cast on shore by shipwreck, wherein many perished, with an account how he was at last as strangely delivered by pirates. Written by himself.
I was born in the city of York in the year 1632. If ever a man was born to be his own destroyer, then I was he. Against the good advice of my father, I went to sea. I forgot the terror that possessed me in my first voyage, and voyaged into danger and calamity again. Even after deliverance from the Turks and landing safe in the Brazils, where I made my fortune, my heart still yearned to wander. But I was yet a young man.
Ultra garrafa de vino, chefe!
Tell me another of your stories, Signor Robinson.
What manner of story would you have, Mr. Wells? Trading with heathens on the Guinea coast? Captured by a Turkish rover?
Tell me about trading in Africa.
There is gold dust, and it can be traded for trinkets.
What kind of trinkets?
Beads, toys, knives, scissors, bits of glass and the like. And not just gold dust, Mr. Wells. Guinea spice, elephant's teeth.
And Negroes, Signor Robinson? You can try them for trinkets?
Why is your interest so drawn to Negroes?
Signor Robinson, you must swear to keep what I say secret.
I do so swear. Now tell me what it is you have in mind.
Signor, you have done well since you arrived in Brazil. You have built up your plantation, and like the other planters, your plans for expansion are hampered by the lack of servants to help you.
True.
Supposing you had servants, as many as you desired.
What are you proposing?
Some planters have a mind to fit out a ship to go to Africa, to buy Negroes.
Such trade may not be entered into without the permission of the King of Spain or Portugal.
This would be a secret trade. There would be no public selling. The cargo would be divided up among the planters according to their investment. You would manage the trading part of the enterprise. Your reward would be a share of the cargo.
That is a fair proposal.
Of course. You may not wish to go to sea again, Signor Robinson. Why should you place yourself in jeopardy? You have wealth, prosperity...
and no one to share it with. I have but one servant, and he cannot speak more than 3 words. I might as well be cast away on some desolate island for all the comforts I enjoy. I work and repose in isolation.
So, you will consider our proposal?
Yes, Mr. Wells. I will.
Had I but considered judiciously, but I was hurried on and obeyed...